Make Yourself an Ark, Part 1, The Darkness. In 1920, Winston Churchill, looking back at the Russian Revolution just 3 years earlier, stated, "From the days of Spartacus Weishaupt to those of Karl Marx to those of Trotsky and the Russian Revolution, this worldwide conspiracy has been steadily growing. This conspiracy played a definitely recognizable role in the tragedy of the French Revolution. This conspiracy has been the mainspring of every subversive movement during the 19th century, and now at last, this band of extraordinary personalities have gripped the Russian people by the hair of their heads and have become practically the undisputed masters of that enormous empire." This is from an article by Winston Churchill published in February 1920 by the London Illustrated Sunday Herald. They did not stop there. Their goal was now within sight, namely to control the whole world, body and soul. So Churchill could see a line from the Russian Revolution running back through Karl Marx and every revolution to the French Revolution and to a character he calls Spartacus Weishaupt, whose first name was really Adam. To understand how Weishaupt got into the picture, we have to look first at another name, Rothschild. A Jewish money-lending business had passed from father to son, and the son adopted the Rothschild sign over the shop as the family name, Rothschild. As Professor Carol Quigley, a professor of history at the Foreign Service School of Georgetown University, revealed in his book, Tragedy and Hope, of all the banking families that developed a vast network to control high finance and the affairs of government, the greatest of these dynasties were the descendants of Mayor Amschel Rothschild, 1743-1812, of Frankfurt. For at least two generations, their male descendants generally married first cousins or even nieces, page 51. Amschel Rothschild, the eldest son, remained in Frankfurt with his father and eventually became treasurer of the German Confederation. The second son, Solomon, founded the Vienna branch. Nathan, the third son, founder of the London branch, became the most powerful man in England. Karl, the fourth son, founded the Naples branch, and James, Jacob, the fifth son, founded the Paris branch, and soon dominated the finances of France. In 1773, Mayor Rothschild met with 12 other wealthy financiers and convinced them that by working together they could control the world revolutionary movement. They could foment wars and revolutions and finance both sides, thereby driving governments on both sides into debt and into dependence on them. This had already happened to some extent by successful manipulation in England. The international moneylenders had financed the removal of the Stuarts and to put William of Orange on the throne of England as William III in 1689. In return, William had given the secret moneylenders who had backed his expedition a royal charter in 1694 to set up the Bank of England. It looked like the Bank of the Nation, but it was privately owned by anonymous international money men. The new king gave them gold and enormous power over England. In an article in the English newspaper, Sunday Observer, of Sunday, May the 22nd, 1988, under the heading, "The Hunt for a Royal Scoop," it was claimed that at last the identity of the main backer is revealed. It was Francisco Lopez Suazo, described as the richest Dutch Jew of his time. It was stated that he once hired the Dutch fleet under Admiral de Ruyter to fight for Spain. Old bank ledgers of the Wissel Bank of Amsterdam, now in the city archives, reveal a total of 1.5 million guilders, the biggest transaction in the ledgers traceable to William. Certainly, if Suazo money did not finance the expedition, it financed the new King of England soon after. According to this article, the Lopez Suazo Family Bankers to William III exhibition was held in June 1988 in the Jewish Museum of Amsterdam. So the so-called Glorious Revolution of 1688 was anything but a spontaneous English movement against the Stuarts and Popery. It was, in its essence, the financial ruling sect of Jewry mainly in action in the early stages of the world movement against all religion and all legitimate government. Once again in action in 1773, when Mayor Rothschild and 12 others, considering what they could do to control of the money of France, agreed to hire Adam Weishaupt. Weishaupt, born a Jew, became a Catholic and professor of canon law at the University of Ingolstadt. Later he apostatized from the Catholic faith. Weishaupt was hired to work out a plan. He completed it in 1776, and on May the 1st, 1776, he founded his secret organization called the Illuminati, while still dean of the Faculty of Law at Ingolstadt University. In 1777, the year after he founded the Illuminati, Weishaupt became a Freemason, joining a Munich lodge. The Illuminati, history's most diabolical long-range conspiracy for the overthrow of every king and every government and all religion, was financed and set up by the international bankers. Weishaupt infiltrated the Masonic lodges, and in the secrecy of these lodges, he could select promising candidates for his secret society. His selected few rose step by step in the Illuminati, and with each step, a little more was revealed to them. If a candidate at any stage displayed shock or revulsion, he never advanced any further, which meant that only the most ruthless and irreligious rose to the highest levels, where they were shown the true satanic purpose of the Illuminati. Weishaupt started with some 2,000 paid followers, all highly talented men, and from the start the members were guaranteed the glory and rewards of personal success in the world. This reminds one of the gospel words, "The devil showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. I will give you all these, he said, if you fall at my feet and worship me." Matthew's Gospel, chapter 4, verse 8. The Illuminati suffered a setback in 1785 when a member, Lance, carrying secret documents, was struck by lightning and killed at Ratisbon. The police found secret documents sewn into his clothing, and as a result, the Bavarian government in 1786 published the original blueprint of the Illuminati plan for world revolution. The basic idea was to destroy all established authority, nationhood and religion. It involved the abolition of property, social authority and nationality, and the abolition of marriage and the family unit. The aims of the Illuminati are, of course, the aims of communism today. It is the same beast one is dealing with. As Douglas Reid wrote in his The Controversy of Zion, Weishaupt's attack on religion was the most distinctive feature of his doctrine. His ideas about the God of reason and the God of nature bring his thought very close to Judaic thought in its relation to the Gentiles. And as Illuminism became communism, and communism came under Jewish leadership, this might be significant. Nesta Webster, in her book World Revolution, 1921, describing the Communist Manifesto, the so-called Charter of Freedom by Marxists, wrote, "And here in plain language are set forth the doctrines laid down in the Code of Weishaupt, the abolition of inheritance, of marriage and the family, of patriotism and of all religion, the institution of the community of women and the communal education of children by the state. This, divested of its trappings, is the real plan of Marxian socialism, which, enveloped in the algebraical phraseology of Das Kapital, is less easy to discover." Page 168. There were Jews with Weishaupt, and a Jew of Portuguese origin, Martinez de Pesquales, organized numerous groups of Illuminati in France. The plan to acquire control of Freemasonry through Illuminist agents and the success achieved is plainly stated in Weishaupt's papers. He called Masonry our nursery garden, and there was a general order for his people to enter it. Masonry was selected as the perfect way of gaining control over French affairs, and this was achieved by infiltrating and capturing the French Grand Orient Freemasonry. was this Illuminist influence that produced the Jacobin clubs that presided over the reign of terror of the French Revolution, indeed the part admittedly played by Grand Orient Freemasonry under Illuminist influence in the French Revolution, caused American Freemasonry to be regarded with suspicion. The French Revolution marked the beginning of atheism in the history of the Christian nations, a triumph for the ideals of the first apostle of atheism, the Freemason Voltaire, a man described by Paulet as the most perfect incarnation of Satan that the world ever saw. Voltaire's policy had been revealed by the correspondence of Frederick II, in which, among other things, Voltaire advocated, finally, when conditions were ripe, a reign of terror was to spread over the whole earth, to wipe out all Christians, and then establish a universal brotherhood without marriage, family, property, law, or God. Writing to Damilaville, Voltaire wrote, "The Christian religion is an infamous, an abominable hydra which must be destroyed by 100 invisible hands. Let us crush the wretch." His doctrine found fatal effects in the French Revolution, but as Douglas Reid pointed out, the French Revolution was not a revolution in France, it was really the world revolution in action, so said Churchill and many others. Since the French Revolution, the self-perpetuating conspiracy of the Illuminati, working through Masonry, has fomented all the revolutionary movements that have shaken Europe and the world, especially, of course, the Russian Revolution. Cardinal Rodriguez, Archbishop of Santiago, Chile, wrote a book in 1925 exposing how the Illuminati, the Satanists, and the Luciferians had imposed a secret society upon a secret society. The Cardinal wrote that not even high 33rd degree Masons knew what went on in the lodges of the Grand Orient and in Pike's new Reformed Palladian Rite. Monsignor George Dillon, in his famous lecture at Edinburgh in October 1884, later published in book form under the title Grand Orient Freemasonry Unmasked, stated, "There is a supreme directory that governs all the secret societies on earth, and he believed this organized atheistic conspiracy to be the commencement of the contest which must take place between Christ and Antichrist, and therefore nothing can be more necessary than that the elect of God should be warned." How right he was, so much so that in 1917 in Fatima, Portugal, Mary, the Mother of God, came down from heaven to warn the world that error from Russia would spread through the whole world. In 1829 in New York, a secret meeting of the Illuminati was told that the nihilists and the atheists and a few others were going to be joined in a united body of secret societies that was secretly known as communism. Stemming from this meeting, a committee was formed that eventually financed Karl Marx, Clinton Roosevelt, a direct ancestor of FDR, Charles Dana, and Horace Greeley, founded the New York Tribune and ran for president in the USA, were on this committee. The fund they established enabled Marx and Engels to produce Das Kapital and the Communist Manifesto in Soho, London. In 1840, while world communism was still secret, the Jewish poet Heinrich Heine, with inside information, wrote, "The shadowy creatures, the nameless monsters to whom the future belongs, communism is the secret name of this tremendous adversary. Communism is the dark era cast in an enormous, if fleeting role in the modern tragedy." Heinrich Heine loved the beauty of the old world in his heart, but his will was with the revolution. His heart says, "I make this statement that the future belongs to the communists," with a feeling of extreme hurt and fear. "With callous hands they will mercilessly smash all those marble images of beauty so dear to my heart, and I am filled with an unutterable sadness." This reminds one of the attack on Michelangelo's famous statue, the Pietà in St. Peter's, in May 1972. Shortly after that attack, a dozen of the foremost artists at the Biennale of Venice requested that the Biennale Prize be awarded to the attacker of the Pietà. It is not difficult to know that one was dealing here with communists. As mentioned, Heinrich Heine's heart was overruled by his will. He wrote, "Yet I frankly admit And that this same communism, so hostile to all my interests and to everything that I hold dear, exercises a fascination over my soul, and I cry out, this old world society has for a long time been judged and found guilty. Let justice be done, let it be destroyed. So the cry of Voltaire rings out again. One more quote from this Jewish poet reveals the real nature of the communist movement. When all is said and done, it was hatred for the church that caused the French Revolution. And he wrote, the throne had been destroyed because it protected the altar. A frank admission of the driving force behind communism and indeed Freemasonry, hatred and destruction of Christianity. What is called Western civilization cannot be conceived without Christianity, so Western civilization must go also. Such aims reveal the Jew, for the Talmudic Jew alone is actuated by a sufficiently violent hatred against Christianity to undertake such an enormous task. This hatred goes back very far. Our Lord said to the Jewish leaders who had stolen religion in his time, your father, the devil, and they responded with the anti-Christian law of the Talmud in time. This anti-Christian extension of the Torah was the inspiration for destructive force, revolutionaries who would in the future be Talmud trained and Talmud controlled. Even the Jewish Encyclopedia admits that their version of the life of Jesus, called Toledot Yeshur, depicts Christ as illegitimate and as a magician. Talmudic hatred expressed concerning the Mother of God is so different from the reverence expressed in the Quran for Jesus and his mother. Muhammad in the Quran notes the destructive force of the Jews, oft as they kindle a beacon fire for war, shall God quench it, and their aim would be to abet disorder on the earth, but God loveth not the abettors of disorder. Nevertheless, the Arabs did accept Jewish help for the conquest of Spain, which was supported with both men and money by the Jews. With victory, the Talmudic Jewish rulers moved their headquarters into Spain until the expulsion of the Jews caused the secret Jewish government to be transferred to Poland. With the partition of Poland in 1772, many Jews came under Russian rule. There already existed in Russia people converted to the worship of Jehovah, people of the Khazar kingdom, a Tartar or Mongolian people. The Jewish Encyclopedia says that their Shagan, or chieftain, with his grandees and a large number of his heathen people embraced Judaism probably about 679 AD. Arthur Kessler, in his The 13th Tribe, Random House, 1976, traced the history of the Khazars, who in the Dark Ages became converted to Judaism, and later, he said, migrated to Poland and formed the cradle of Western Jewry. They, of course, had no lineal connection with the chosen people of God of the Bible, nor rights to dispossess Palestinians, which is another question. It is interesting to note that these people were in residence in strong numbers in Kiev, the traditional holy city of Russian Christianity, where there was a frightful massacre of the Russian clergy and an enormous number of people during the Red Terror of the Bolshevist Revolution. With the collapse of their kingdom around 1000 AD, the Khazars had moved around Russia while remaining the political and religious subjects of the Talmudic government. The Commission of Inquiry of Genkin on Bolshevist proceedings during the period 1918-19, on account of the Red Terror, computed 1,700,000 victims. The Russian Revolution of 1917 that produced such horrors could be called the Jewish Russian Revolution because it was masterminded by Jews and produced an almost all-Jewish government in Russia. Official Bolshevik statements in 1920 showed that in a total of 545 members, the Bolshevik administration comprised of 447 Jews, 30 Russians, and 68 others. The British government's white paper of 1919, Russia Number 1, a report on Bolshevism, quoted from a report sent to Mr. Balfour in London in 1918 by the Netherlands minister in St. Petersburg, M. Udendijk, in which he stated Bolshevism is organized work by Jews who have no nationality and whose one object is to destroy for their own ends the existing order of things. According to Douglas Reed in his book, The Controversy of Zion, Oudendijk's report was deleted from later editions of the British official publication, but a correspondent of the London Times, Robert Wilton, who experienced the Bolshevik Revolution, preserved a copy of the original official record. Wilton was the author of Russia's Agony and the Last Days of the Romanovs. Another British professional political observer who described the Bolshevik Revolution as Jewish and who was also an intelligence agent was Paul Jukes, author of Red Dusk and The Morrow. The United States ambassador in Russia, David R. Francis, reported similarly, quote, "The Bolshevik leaders here, most of whom are Jews, and 90% of whom are returned exiles, care little for Russia or any other country, but are internationalists, and they are trying to start a worldwide social revolution." End of quote. The question is, exiles returned from where? Later, the U.S. Army intelligence chief on the scene during the Bolshevik Revolution noted that most of the early commissars guilty of the bloodiest atrocities were Jews from America. The American State Department decimal file 861.00-5339 has a central document entitled Bolshevism and Judaism, dated November 13, 1918, that asserts there can be no doubt that the Russian Revolution was started and engineered by the following people, all Jews: Jacob Schiff of Kunlob & Company, a Jewish firm, with directors Jacob Schiff, Felix Warburg, Otto H. Kahn, Mortimer L. Schiff, Jerome J. Hanur. Also mentioned Guggenheim, Max Breuton, Isaac Seligman. The report states that Jacob Schiff made a public announcement that it was due to his financial influence that the Russian Revolution was successfully accomplished, and that in the spring of 1917, Jacob Schiff started to finance Trotsky, a Jew, for the purpose of accomplishing a social revolution in Russia. According to a grandson of Jacob Schiff, $20 million was the sum invested for the triumph of Bolshevism in Russia. This was published in an article in the New York Journal, American, of February the 3rd, 1949. It proved to be a lucrative investment. It is known that Jacob Schiff's Kunlob Bank had received 600 million rubles in gold from Bolshevik Russia by 1922, according to Arseniy Gulevich's Tsarism and the Revolution. B.C. Forbes noted in his Men Who Are Making America, pages 344 and following, that Schiff's investments in socialist Russia had proved a most profitable venture. It was reported in the New York Times on March 24, 1917, that Jacob Schiff, unable to attend the celebration of the victory of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia that was held in Carnegie Hall, sent a telegram expressing his deep regrets for being unable to celebrate with the friends of Russian freedom the actual reward of what he had hoped and striven for these long years. Many years of plotting indeed. Back in 1905, the principal Zionist journal of its day, Maccabean, New York, stated in November 1905, obviously referring to the 1905 revolution, "The revolution in Russia is a Jewish revolution, a crisis in Jewish history." Going further back in history, we have the warnings of a Jew who became a Christian Prime Minister of Britain, Disraeli, who repeatedly warned against the world revolution and had identified it as a Jewish plot. In 1852, Disraeli had given his opinion as follows: "The influence of the Jews may be traced in the last outbreak of the destructive principle in Europe. An insurrection takes place against tradition and aristocracy, against religion and property. The natural equality of men and the abrogation of property are proclaimed by the secret societies who form provisional governments, and men of Jewish race are found at the head of every one of them." This, of course, is exactly what happened in Russia 70 years after the 1848 outbreaks of which Disraeli spoke. Disraeli also said, "The most skillful manipulators of property ally themselves with communists. The peculiar and chosen people touch the hands of all the scum and low castes of Europe. For the purpose of destroying Christianity, of course, as Disraeli pointed out." Another Prime Minister of Britain, Winston Churchill, in his article published in the Illustrated Sunday Herald of February the 8th, 1920, wrote as follows. "There is no need to exaggerate the part played in the creation of Bolshevism and in the actual bringing about of the Russian Revolution by these international and, for the most part, atheistical Jews. It is certainly a very great one. It probably outweighs all others. With the notable exception of Lenin, the majority of leading figures are Jews. Moreover, the principal inspiration and driving power comes from the Jewish leaders." And Churchill continued with this, "In the Soviet institutions, the predominance of Jews is even more astonishing, and the prominent, if not indeed the principal, part in the system of terrorism applied by the extraordinary commissions for combating counter-revolution has been taken by Jews, and in some notable cases by Jewesses. The same evil prominence was obtained by Jews in the brief period of terror during which Bela Kun ruled in Hungary." End of quote. In one remarkable paragraph of this article, Churchill, back in 1920, came to the heart of the matter in an almost prophetic way when he wrote, "And it may well be that this same astounding race may at the present time be in the actual process of producing another system of morals and philosophy, as malevolent as Christianity was benevolent, which, if not arrested, would shatter irretrievably all that Christianity has rendered possible. It would almost seem as if the gospel of Christ and the gospel of Antichrist were destined to originate among the same people, and that this mystic and mysterious race had been chosen for the supreme manifestations both of the divine and the diabolical." End of quote. What a pity Churchill apparently had forgotten all this at the time of Yalta. But of course, a very influential Jew, Bernard Baruch, had entered into Churchill's life. When Karl Marx was asked what his objective in life was, he said, "To dethrone God and destroy capitalism." What he said about dethroning God, he meant. What he said about destroying capitalism was bluff, at least as regards Jewish international capitalism, which had created and financed his so-called Marxism. Mikhail Bakunin, who died in 1876, Russian revolutionary and leading spirit of 19th century anarchism, was a bitter opponent of Marxism and struggled with Marx for leadership of the First International. Bakunin believed that organized Jewry was not genuinely interested in correcting social injustice and was instead merely using its left and right arms of communism and capitalism to seize power for itself. He said, "Marx is a Jew and is surrounded by a crowd of little more or less intelligent, scheming, agile, speculating Jews." Bakunin went on to say, "The Jewish world is today largely at the disposal of Marx or Rothschild. This may seem strange. What could there be in common between communism and high finance? Ho ho. The communism of Marx seeks a strong state centralization, and where this exists, there must inevitably exist a state central bank." End of quote. Bakunin pointed out that while this would mean converting working people into a uniform mass, while, quote, "the privilege of ruling would be in the hands of the skilled and the learned, with a wide scope left for profitable crooked deals carried on by the Jews, who would be attracted by the enormous extension of the international speculations of the national banks." Polemic against the Jews. Gilbert Keith Chesterton, poles apart from the revolutionary anarchist Bakunin, could nevertheless agree with him on one point when he, Chesterton, wrote, capitalism and communism are so very nearly the same thing in ethical essence that it would not be strange if they did take leaders from the same ethnological elements, while noting that the big bankers of capitalism and the chief founders of communism had one thing in common: they were Jews. In his work, The End of the Armistice, Chesterton wrote, "Both capitalism and communism rest on the same idea, a centralization of wealth which destroys private property." And in his work, As I Was Saying, he wrote, "For communism is the child and heir of capitalism, and the son would still greatly resemble his father, even if he had really killed him." In his work, The Common Man, Chesterton shrewdly diagnosed what the atheists sought to find in communism. All they want is some supposed betterment of humanity, which will be a bribe for depriving humanity of divinity. What the betterment of humanity means to the Jews is revealed in an editorial of the London Jewish World of February the 9th, 1883, in which it is stated, quote, "The great ideal of Judaism is that the whole world shall be imbued with Jewish teachings, and that in a universal brotherhood of nations, a greater Judaism in fact, all the separate races and religions shall disappear," end of quote. The dialectical materialism of the Jewish-spawned Marxist revolution would sweep all before it to triumph in Jerusalem. The evil genius behind Marx is the deep-thinking Moses Hess, a Jew well-schooled in the Talmud and Jewish Kabbalah, who evolved the idea of using communism as a battering ram to enable Jews to realize their age-old dream of next year in Jerusalem. Hess, in his book Ramon Jerusalem, sounded the cry for all militant Zionists to push on from communist triumphs in Europe and rebuild their world, political capital, and Palestine. "Between Europe and Far Asia," he wrote, "the roads that lead to India and China, the world will once again pay homage to the oldest of peoples." The Jewish historian Dr. Kastein also sees Zionism as the possessor of a world mission re-entering into a destined inheritance, culminating in world dominion, of which it was criminally dispossessed in 70 AD with the destruction of Jerusalem. Dr. Kastein sees this triumphant return as the golden age when, quote, "history may be resumed," end of quote, after what they consider, of course, the meaningless Christian era, which is referred to in the Jewish Encyclopedia as CE, standing for Common Era, to avoid using AD, Year of the Lord, from the Latin Anno Domini. Of course, this triumphant return to Jerusalem for the rest of mankind, called Goyim, as cattle in the Talmud, involves the destruction of heathen nation-states as the prelude to the triumphant takeover of Jewish super-capitalists who are in control of global high finance. It involves the destruction of all religion and nationhood and the establishment of the super-state ruling the world by ruthless terror. The Torah Talmud of the Jews is the source of the idea of destroying nations, and the destructive principle involved in this world takeover plan lay naked before the world in the red terror of the Russian Bolshevik Revolution. That terror was to continue once Lenin had okayed wholesale butchery. They set to work liquidating all the leadership elements of the Gentile Russian population who offered any conceivable threat or alternative to the Bolshevik system. The liquidating was carried out by the secret department called Pan-Russian Extraordinary Commission, known by the acronym CHECA. Over the years, the names were changed to OVPU, NKVD, MVD, MGB, and finally KGB, but it was always the same beast that tortured and slaughtered millions. From the beginning, Lenin demanded extermination of entire social groups, and the secretary of the Leningrad Soviet, Applebaum, better known as Zinoviev, in the official organ of the Soviet, Krasnaya Gazeta, on August 31, 1918, demanded floods of blood as much as possible, quote. And they certainly got it. The Commission of Inquiry of Denikin on Bolshevist proceedings during the period 1918-19 an account of the Red Terror computed 1,700,000 victims. William C. Bullitt, America's first ambassador to the USSR, in his book A Talk with Voroshilov, relates that at a banquet in Russia in 1934, Voroshilov told him that in 1919 he persuaded 11,000 Tsarist officers at Kiev to surrender by promising them that if they surrendered, they and their wives and families would be permitted to return home. When they surrendered, he executed all the officers and all male children and sent the wives and daughters into Russian army brothels where few lived for more than 3 months. Winston Churchill related how at a dinner in Moscow, Stalin casually described how about 10 million kulaks, small farmers, had been uprooted for resisting farm collectivization and that the great bulk of them had been wiped out. The nature of the beast does not change down the years, and floods of blood was still the demand. The cream of the Polish Army Officer Corps suffered a similar fate to that of the Tsarist officers when the Katyn Forest Massacre took place in 1940. About 10,000 military officers and 6,000 non-coms, police officials and political leaders were shot and buried in mass graves. It was Beria, a monster even dreaded by his own people, who presided over the Katyn Massacre. It was Beria who slaughtered the anti-communists in the Baltic countries. Beria was a Jew and a Jewish executive at the head of the all-important secret police apparatus, had been the policy in Soviet Russia, with one or two supposed exceptions, since the beginning. The most notable of these have been Yagoda, Beria, and Andropov. Yagoda, which is Russian for Yehuda, the Jew, extracted the evidence of the great purges of the late 1930s. The first head of the Cheka was the Jew Moses Uritsky. His successor, Dzerzhinsky, one could say figured in a strange way in the August 1991 upheaval in Moscow, when millions all over the world saw on TV his huge statue being toppled by the crowd. It had stood in front of the KGB headquarters. The death camps of the immense gulag bureaucracy of the KGB were exposed by Nobel Prize winner Solzhenitsyn in his major work, The Gulag Archipelago. Solzhenitsyn had spent 8 years as a prisoner in the gulag. The English historian Robert Conquest, author of The Great Terror and The Nation Killers, the leading authority on Bolshevik political murders, in a special report he prepared for the United States Senate, arrived at a prison camp death total for the Stalinist period, 1930 to 1950, alone, of 20 million, while commenting, "It is almost certainly too low and might require an increase of 50% or so." Estimates prepared by experts for the Interdenominational Service to commemorate the victims of communism, held at the Royal Albert Hall, London, October 31, 1967, attributed 45 million victims to the Russian Revolution and the consequent famines and purges. About 19 million of those victims died in the labor camps between 1921 and 1960. Solzhenitsyn himself cites the research of the exiled Soviet statistician I.A. Kurganov, who had access to secret government figures, as estimating that the number of people killed by the Soviet police between the revolution and 1959 totaled at least 66 million. Lenin once wrote in a Pravda article, "When we are reproached with cruelty, we wonder how many people can forget the most elementary Marxism." Elementary Marxism, in the definitions of Marx and Engels, accepted the fact that the remaking of the world will have to be a cruel and ruthless task, and that it will involve the destruction of all who stand in the way. And yet what happened in Russia, in all its naked savagery, was claimed by Jewish sources as their work. Let us consider some of those claims. In an article entitled Services of Jewry to the Working Class by M. Cohan, published in The Communist, Kharkov, on April 12, 1919, and republished in the Communist newspaper On to Moscow, Rostov-on-Don, we have the following. Without exaggeration, it may be said that the great Russian social revolution was indeed accomplished by the hands of the Jews. The symbol of Jewry, which for centuries has struggled against capitalism, has become also the symbol of the Russian proletariat, which can be seen even in the fact of the red five-pointed star, which in former times, as is well known, was the symbol of Zionism and Jewry. End of quote. A Zionist who called himself Mentor wrote in the Jewish Chronicle of London in 1919, "There is much in the fact of Bolshevism itself, in the fact that so many Jews are Bolsheviks, in the fact that the ideals of Bolshevism at many points are consonant with the finest ideals of Judaism." End of quote. The American Hebrew, New York, stated on September 20, 1920, "What Jewish idealism and Jewish discontent have so powerfully contributed to produce in Russia, the same historic qualities of the Jewish mind are tending to promote in other countries." End of quote. Rabbi Stephen S. Wise, in his time the leading Zionist organizer in the United States, in the 1910 to 1950 period, said, as reported in the New York Times, March 24, 1917, "I believe that of all the achievements of my people, none has been nobler than the part the sons and daughters of Israel have taken in the great movement which has culminated in a free Russia." End of quote. Years later, when his so-called great movement had settled, he wrote the following in Opinion magazine, December 1933. "Jews occupy almost all important ambassadorial positions. Universities, professions, judiciary, and administration now have a greater percentage of Jews than of any other nationality. Anti-Semitism has been declared a state offense and is punished as counter-revolution." End of quote. It is interesting to know that Lenin, in a law promulgated in Izvestia, July 27, 1918, declared that anti-Semites were outside the law, meaning that Bolsheviks could kill them on the spot. Later on, Lenin wrote that anti-Semitism was the means of counter-revolution. 20 years later, in an interview published in the Communist Daily Worker, December 12, 1938, Joseph Stalin made this statement: "In the USSR, anti-Semitism is strictly prosecuted as a phenomenon profoundly hostile to the Soviet system. According to the laws of the USSR, active anti-Semites are punished by death." End of quote. James Waterman Wise, son of Rabbi Stephen, in an article in the magazine New Masses that he edited on October 29, 1935, took to task prominent Jews who, as he wrote, "hysterically deny that communism is Jewish and frenziedly repudiate Jews who are communists. Their statement libels Soviet Russia and lies about the Jewish people." End of quote. The American Protestant theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, in a speech before the Jewish Institute of Religion on October 3, 1934, stated, "Marxism is the modern form of Jewish prophecy." Nobody in the audience objected to that. Certainly, this is a statement of grave import when we consider what the Marxist monstrosity has inflicted on humanity worldwide in this century. When Bakunin linked the names of Marx and Rothschild in stating that the Jewish world is today largely at the disposal of Marx and Rothschild, he was spot on, of course, because the Rothschilds were linked to Marx in the same way as they were linked to Spartacus Weishaupt at the beginning of the Illuminati conspiracy. From the beginning, the Illuminati used an alias or cover name when dealing with one another. Adam Weishaupt was known as Spartacus. The practice was continued. The rulers of the communist revolution in Russia were known to the world by aliases. The real name of Lenin was Ulyanov. His mother was Jewish. Trotsky's real name was Bronstein. He was a Jew. Among the bagmen who transported hundreds of millions of dollars to the Bolsheviks in Russia was the millionaire Israel Helphand, who used the pseudonym Parvus. A biography of Parvus entitled The Merchant of Revolution was published in London in 1965 by Zeman and Charlo. The secretary of the Leningrad Soviet, Applebaum, was known as Zinoviev, and so on.